You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to Stephen Thompson from NPR Music about some of his favorite albums of 2016.
First, 17 federal intelligence agencies came to the consensus that Russia was behind the hacks into Democratic Party computers and aimed at influencing the November election. The consensus comes after President-elect Donald Trump and his supporters expressed doubts that there was enough evidence to show that Russia was responsible for the hacking.
Last week, President Obama said that he plans on taking action against Russia for trying to meddle in U.S. elections. Here's a clip from a conversation he had with NPR's Steve Inskeep.
I think there is no doubt that when any foreign government tries to impact the integrity of our elections, that we need to take action, and we will, at a time and place of our own choosing. Some of it may be explicit and publicized, some of it may not be. But Mr. Putin is well aware of my feelings about this because I spoke to him directly about it.
Obama was also careful to say that while the hacks were to Trump's benefit, he wasn't saying that the Trump campaign had a role in the attacks.
Michael Sullmeyer joins us now. He's the Cybersecurity Project Director at the Harvard Kennedy School, and he previously worked in the office of the Secretary of Defense, where he served as Director for Plans and Operations for Cyber Policy. Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Before we dig into some of the history of Russian cyber attacks, the big question now seems to be the intelligence community is saying these attacks came from Russia. The Donald Trump campaign and those around him are raising doubts about it. How do we know, if we're looking at a particular cyber attack, where it came from?
That's a great question. Attribution for a long time has been a topic that scholars and practitioners have debated, and that it's hard, but it's not nearly as hard as it used to be. And that's because, A, there's a lot more entities now watching what happens in cyberspace as opposed to 10 years ago. And B, there's a lot of private sector groups, companies that make money off of writing about it, that put information out there as well. So in a paper that Ben Buchanan and I recently wrote for the Carnegie Endowment, we go through the evidence that we see that's public. But you've also heard that President Obama will be releasing some additional information before January 20, providing what the government has to clarify why they believe Russia was behind the hacks.
So you're thinking that this is legit, that Russian operatives working for elements of the Russian government were interfering in the U.S. election?
They were certainly trying to interfere. Mm-hmm. Whether what's been hard to discern is exactly what the effect has been and at a technical level what the effect was, but there was certainly the attempt to interfere, and everything that I've seen points to Russian origins. You heard the president talk about his thoughts about why if something goes on in Russia, it's unlikely that President Putin doesn't know about it. But the fact that it became such a topic of conversation and these allegations that the system was rigged and linking that to hacking when the president-elect as a candidate called for more hacking to be done against his opponent, that was very problematic to hear.
Now, you've written in a paper for the Task Force on U.S. Policy Toward Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia that, quoting here, the Russian cyber threat is significant but hardly catastrophic. It's neither new nor unprecedented. I want to get into that precedent here. This goes back a couple decades, doesn't it, with the first big Russian attack in the U.S.?
That's absolutely right. And we talk about this a little bit more in the paper and have some good citations for those who want to go deep. But what we also are trying to focus on is that even the most sophisticated actors in cyberspace don't always need to use the most sophisticated tools or the most sophisticated techniques. So as we talk about the Russian ability to collect information, what we would ordinarily think of as espionage, they've been in this business a long time. And they're not the only ones who have been in that business a long time. We've been in that business a long time also. What we focus on in the paper and what I hope people will keep an eye on going forward, 2017 and beyond, is the ability for states like Russia and others to hold some of our critical infrastructure at risk through cyber operations. That is, being able to create effects in physical infrastructure if they wanted to, as a result of having established a presence through cyberspace.
Talking to Michael Solmeyer from the Harvard Kennedy School, looking at cyber warfare, accusations that Russia attempted to interfere in the U.S. presidential elections, just one of the possible elements of cyber warfare out there from Russia and others. And let's follow up on that infrastructure point. Russia has demonstrated its power to do some things like that, hasn't it, in Ukraine and elsewhere?
Exactly right. There was a situation earlier this year, end of last year, where power in part of Ukraine was taken offline, and all signs there again pointed to Russian origins. It's also worth noting that in an indictment unsealed earlier this year, our Justice Department indicted several Iranians for trying to hack into a dam in New York and the control system that powered that dam, which was an environmental preserve, it looked like. It was physically offline at the time, so it does not appear that there was true physical risk. But it's when I say the Russians aren't the only ones who have been trying to hold that kind of infrastructure at risk.
As you mentioned earlier, the United States engages in information gathering around the world in various ways, including cyber intelligence. There have been accusations that the U.S. used cyber attacks, I believe, in Iran in the past. Are we on any kind of moral high ground on these issues?
Well, the reality is, you know, it's a dangerous world, and it's a time where so many different parts of the world are in a period of transition or in a period of crisis or struggle, and the ability to make sure that our decision makers have the access to as much reliable information as possible collected in a variety of different ways. You never want to just rely on one particular source or method. That's a really important requirement for our government and for our administration going forward.
Is this a really effective, a cost-effective method at establishing one's influence in the world? I mean, Russia could put a lot of money into building, I don't know, more aircraft carriers, or human intelligence could take a lot of time and a lot of money. Cyber intelligence, by comparison, is pretty cheap, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a great point. It is relatively cheap, especially compared to an aircraft carrier or something else that gives you more overt physical presence. So not only is it's cheap, but cyber capabilities offer the owner an opportunity to be quite stealthy about how they are seen, when they are seen, and the kind of effects they can generate. It's a very, very flexible tool.
And Michael, one point you raise in that paper I referenced earlier is that Russia is doing something a little different. A lot of countries are collecting information via some form of hacking. They've weaponized it a little bit by releasing it publicly. Is there a lot of precedent for that so far?
There's not a lot of precedent for it. It's a good observation. But that's what marks the distinction between what I would interpret as a traditional intelligence gathering or collection activity, breaking in and stealing information, versus then weaponizing that information, or in this case, releasing that information publicly to achieve an effect, in this case, to undermine the integrity of how Americans feel about the election. So that has not been a regular tactic. I don't believe it's the first time, but it's certainly not a regular tactic for intelligence activities.
We're talking to Michael Solmeyer, Cybersecurity Project Director at the Harvard Kennedy School. We're looking at the growing consensus from intelligence agencies that Russian hacking aimed to interfere with the U.S. election.
And we want to hear from you. You can call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. What do you think of allegations of Russian hacking in the election campaign? How do you think that the U.S. should respond? How much does this worry you, if at all? And do you believe that President Obama, who only has a month left in the White House, should be doing anything? Do you think Donald Trump should be taking action? Our number is 800-642-1234.
We're continuing our conversation now with Michael Sollmeyer, Cybersecurity Project Director at the Harvard Kennedy School, talking about Russian hacking aimed at meddling in the U.S. election.
And we want to hear from you. You can call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Do you agree with the intelligence community that Russian hackers aim to influence the U.S. election? How should President Obama respond, if you think he should respond at all? And tell us how you think President-elect Donald Trump might respond to intelligence about this alleged Russian hacking. You can call 800-642-1234.
And Michael, you've written that we need better defense, better detection, and better deterrence. I want to take those one at a time. Better defense, what would that look like in the cyber realm?
Sure. The reality is that while the United States probably has the nicest rocks in cyberspace, we also live in the glassiest house. And so we have to make sure that in the years going forward, we make our house a little less glassy so that we can defend ourselves better. There's a couple different aspects to it. One is we've got to, first, our government needs to defend its own federal government networks, like military networks, White House network. And second, the federal government needs to figure out how it's going to help businesses and other institutions within the United States have the security benefits of the kind of information that our government has. And this is why the Obama administration has spent such a long time trying to improve information sharing between the public and the private sector. There's a lot more to do, but that's a really good place to start.
Before we get back to detection and deterrence, let's bring on a caller. Virginia is with us in Portage. Virginia, hi.
Hi. Well, I was wondering about, am I still on the call?
You're still going, Virginia. Go for it.
Oh, okay, because the car is going. So I was wondering in terms of international business has become almost more fewer boundaries between nations, and what is the future of international law in terms of looking at these things? Because obviously laws from country to country aren't going to be as consistent.
Virginia, thanks for the call. Michael, it's an international problem. Do we have international law to match?
It's a great question, Virginia. You are right on track with many in the international law community who have spent time trying to figure out how developments in cyberspace affect and reflect international law. So far, the consensus has been that international law and the law of armed conflict continue to apply in cyberspace, just like they do in other areas of potential conflict between and among nations. But the reality is there are going to be evolutions that have to occur in just in terms of property and tax and all other aspects of law to account for the sort of non-jurisdictional nature of cyberspace. So it's a great question that I try to get law students and master's students interested in researching. And time will tell just how much it changes.
Thanks for the call, Virginia. We'll go next to Jim on the line in Hartford. Jim, hi.
Hi there. Hi, Michael. Hey, I think we're missing one big question that just gets skipped over. Are we talking, as far as the Russian hacking going, are we talking about about the WikiLeaks information? Because we know it's not related to the machines. And if we're talking about the WikiLeaks information that is being hacked, I think the WikiLeaks is pretty much the closest thing we have to real news. And I really think this Russian hacking thing is a fake story. I think this is the definition of fake news. I really do.
Fake in what sense, Jim?
Well, you're saying Russian hacking, but nobody's saying what the actual hack was. Was it the WikiLeaks?
Gotcha, Jim. I hear where you're coming from. So to be clear, nobody's saying that Russians hacked election voting machines. A good point of clarification, Jim. Michael, refresh us. What was hacked that ended up at WikiLeaks?
Yeah, thanks, Jim. It's a good opportunity for clarification. I think the question that emerges is where did the information that appeared on WikiLeaks, where did it come from? Right, where did all the John Podesta emails, where did that come from? Why did they become public? How did they become public? And that's really the question of the role of the Russian hackers that has been the focus of the conversation. And it's that the allegation is that the Russians were the ones who achieved unauthorized access into different computer networks and into different email accounts, removed that information, and then through probably a couple different channels provided it to, among others, WikiLeaks and DC Leaks. So I think that's how the chain of custody may go.
Jim, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Michael Sulmeier, Cybersecurity Project Director at the Harvard Kennedy School, looking at allegations of Russian hacking related to the U.S. elections. Michael, wanted to get back to your three-part plan here. Better defense, better detection is the next step. And you write that there's been a long-term effort by Russian operations to find loopholes, find future opportunities. What would we have to do to detect an ongoing effort like that?
Yeah, the detection, on the one hand, we have reasons to be optimistic because our government and so many other allied governments have spent a lot of money and a lot of time over the last several years getting better at detecting malicious activity in cyberspace. So there's one area, at least, of hope. The difficulty is that for the aggressor or for the criminal or the perpetrator, there's always new techniques they come up with to evade and to hide and be stealthy. So it's always going to be a cat and mouse game. But what's changed, I think, in the last several years is that it's now almost impossible to be completely anonymous in cyberspace. And today, you'll likely be seen. It may take a little time to figure out exactly who you are as the perpetrator, but now you'll be detected more likely than not.
You know, it occurs to me, Michael, that often the most vulnerable point of any system is likely to be the person sitting in front of the terminal, where a phishing scheme or something like that, they click on the wrong link, and that ultimately opens up the door to a lot of secured or hopefully secured information. What can we do to help limit the damage that can be done by the human link here?
Well, that's a great observation, and a colleague at the Belfer Center, where I work, has a paper in the Harvard Business Review from last year that talks a lot about that. Admiral Winnefeld, Sandy Winnefeld, wrote that paper. And the reality is that more training, more education, and more thinking like the how to better help the human is a big element of getting better at cybersecurity. However, and I think where we need to have a much more serious conversation is, why are humans left in the position of being able to cause so much harm to themselves and to the network and to others? And that's going to be a larger question of what are the role that Internet service providers play, right? Is it the wild, wild west when you sign up for Comcast or RCN Internet service? Or are they going to play a more active role in security? And finally, what's the role of the federal government going to be in holding these entities accountable for better cybersecurity online?
Getting back to your recommendations for the future, better defense, better detection, and better deterrence. And we've heard President Obama talking about retaliation. What would that look like? What kind of things can we do to deter cyber attacks on the U.S.?
Yeah, great question. The issue to deter a cyber attack on the United States, you have to make sure that the potential perpetrator is very clear that they will face a cost in an area where they are vulnerable. And that area where the adversary is vulnerable is not necessarily where we're vulnerable. I said that we live in the glassiest house in cyberspace. That doesn't mean that our adversaries live in an equally glassy house. So what deterrence looks like in this situation may not be threatening more or retaliatory cyber attacks. Quite the contrary, it could mean, for example, cutting off access to international banking, something that could be very valuable for a certain regime. But for us or for other states, there may have plenty of other alternatives. So look for a cross-domain or asymmetric solution to deter.
What do we do about our infrastructure? Do we have a lot of things in place that were, you know, servers and whatever that were put in place before we were worried about cyber attacks? And as we see the new Internet of Things, the refrigerators and things like that have already been used in cyber attacks. Do we need to go back and redo everything we've done?
That's a great question, and I fear that at least in the short term, we do need to have a hard look at how vulnerable we are making our infrastructure by connecting different systems that were never designed to be connected to the Internet, and yet we go ahead and we connect them to the Internet. So I think developers and manufacturers are going to have to invest more in security. We're going to have to look at upgrading the existing series of control systems. And finally, in the immediate short term, it may be prudent to just take certain systems offline and disconnect them from such easy access to the Internet until you've had a chance to audit the kind of security vulnerability that you acquire by putting it immediately on the Internet.
Michael, what's next? Are we at the beginning of an unstoppable cyber arms race, or can we put in place some international law that lets us play nicer together?
Well, it's a good question, and I have to imagine, just based on what we've seen over the last several months, that there's no slowdown coming in the conflict that's emerging in cyberspace. Quite the contrary, other states around the world use it and look at it as a tool against the United States that, as you had pointed out earlier, is relatively cheap, can be relatively stealthy, and can impose some cost on us without being so escalatory to demand a kinetic response. It's too attractive right now for a lot of states. So we're going to have to do a lot better at improving our defenses, making sure we're detecting the adversaries, try as they may, and ultimately sending a clear deterrent message that serious cyber attacks won't be tolerated.
Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for the time. It was a pleasure.
That's Michael Solmeyer. He's the Cybersecurity Project Director at the Harvard Kennedy School and previously worked in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, where he served as Director for Plans and Operations for Cyber Policy. He joined us to talk about what the future holds after intelligence agencies agreed that Russian hackers aimed to influence the 2016 U.S. election.